All right, I think we should start. All right, so I thought since we are soon coming to Purim, that we would discuss another element, aspect of the Megillah, and take note of how this story actually is alluded to or references another biblical story. What I'm referring to is perhaps one of the critical moments of the Megillah, which is the chapter in which Mordechai is trying to convince Esther to go to the king to save the people. That's the fourth chapter of the Megillah. So we'll start, we'll read through that chapter, and hopefully see some new things in this chapter. The chapter begins this way. Mordechai yodad kol asher nasa. That's how the chapter. Mordechai knew all that was happening. Yeah, we do need Tanakh. Do we have Tanakh? Yeah, we need Tanakh, definitely. 100%. Okay, we'll just wait a second and we'll get to that. You don't have any here? Okay. Just about to start. Sorry, yes. Okay, everybody has a Tanakh? It's good. A couple more over here, we'd be good. Yes. Get the Tanakh over there. Do you have a Tanakh? No, why not? Why not? No extra charge. Okay, come, let's start. Well, Mordechai yodad kol asher, that's how the chapter, Mordechai knows everything. It's chapter 4 of the Megillah. Vayikra Mordechai et begadda, vayubach sak vayefe, vayetze betoch ha'ir, vayizak zaka gadol ha'amara. So Mordechai knows about the decree that's been issued in the last chapter, all Jews in all the 127 states to be killed on the 13th day of the 12th month, month of Adar. Mordechai knows everything. So he tears his garments, he puts on sackcloth, covers, puts ashes on his, put ashes on his body, and he goes in the midst of the city. He cries out with a great cry. Vayavo al gufnei shara melech. He came up to the gate of the king. Ki ein lovo oshar hamelech bilvusak. So he went up to the gate of the king, because one may not enter the gate of the king wearing sackcloth. Apparently that's the rule. You can't wear garments of mourning and be in the gate. We'll read a few verses and comment. Next verse is, Ubechol medina medina, in every state, Mekom asher dvar ha-melech v'dato magia, whenever the king's edict reached, all the states, Evo gadol ha-yudim, there was a great mourning for the Jews, Tonu v'chiyim v'speid, Sakva efer yutzal rabim. So widespread, sackcloth, ashes, all the Jews in all the provinces. Vatavona narota steva sariseva yagidua vatitchalcha hamakoma od, vatishrach begodim or abishat Mordechai, who rasir sakomi alav lokibel. So this is the first piece of our chapter. Esther is told, we're told by her maidens who tell her what about this, and she sends clothing to Mordechai. Get him dressed, to take off his sackcloth and to dress in normal clothing. But the Megillah says, for go kibel, he refuses to accept it. That's how this chapter begins. So before we get to the other text, let's start with this. The point over here is the chapter tells us Mordechai knows. and he's in a state of mourning. In fact, he goes, we are told, up to the gate of the king, but does not enter the gate. You may not enter the gate of the king wearing sackcloth. Let me begin by the first question, which is, why does the Megillah tell us this? Well, why is it important to know? What is the idea here that you can't enter the gate of the king wearing sackcloth? Seems like it would have been sufficient to say he went up, he's in the street. He's in the street. But to make a point that he can't enter the gate, what do you think? Yeah. Why is it important to know that, I'm saying? I'm not asking what the reason is. I'm asking for the reason for the rule. I'm asking why the Megillah tells us. It's a different question. Why are we informed about this? What emerges from this book? Author's intention, I want to use author's intention, but what is the message over here that we're being told? Because after all, we don't need to know this. The Megillah... It's not such a long book. It leaves out many pieces of information. What is it about this particular piece of information that's significant? I can think of three things, actually.
Creating separation.
Between whom and whom?
Between the royalty and the common
people. And that's important because? What is the relevance to the book, I'm asking? Yeah? Okay, so right, so that's okay. So what you're suggesting then is that the first suggestion is that the people in the palace don't necessarily understand what's going on in the streets. In this case, in particular, we know that's the case in terms of Esther. Esther has no idea. In fact, she's the only Jew who doesn't know. It says in all the states, all Jews are mourning, is what it says. The only person who doesn't seem to know is Esther, because we'll discover very shortly she has to be. She doesn't know why this is. She sends clothing to Mordechai. She knows Mordechai is in trouble for some reason, but it becomes clear in the continuation that she has no idea what the problem is. Yes, what else?
For Mordechai, you could say this is maybe a moment in which he says, Khan, in terms of his assimilation and his willingness to blend into the society in which he finds himself. He already has a Persian name. He deals with
and Mordechai doesn't have a Persian name. Mordechai is a Persian name. Let me make a following point. Mordechai is probably Marduk, but that's not what I'm talking about. In other words, it's not that in the book Mordechai in this book, I claim, I would argue, has very little Persian identity. He's called Mordechai the Jew from beginning to end. He's anything if not consistent. He doesn't bow down, and he's Mordechai the Jew throughout. He is not an assimilated Jew in this book. He may have the name Marduk, but it's not that the name Marduk per se defines him as a Persian. Esther is another story, because Esther does not have the name Esther to begin with. She's Hadassah, who becomes Esther. That's a different story. She is fully assimilated, revealing to no one that she's a Jew, and in this chapter becomes clear that she doesn't see herself primarily as a Jew, at least for the first part of the chapter. So I don't think about Mordechai. Mordechai has his lines that he draws, but it's not about assimilation. I wouldn't say that. Yeah? Doesn't challenge. He doesn't answer.
I realize he doesn't answer, but he's establishing himself as
we're all saying yes. Yes.
If he just establishes that he's had no contact with her since she entered the palace. I mean, that just shows that he can't get past the gate, and she
right. So in other words, let's put it this way: we know that he has some contact with her because we know earlier he saves the life of the king, and he tells Esther. So that we know. But in this particular case, you're suggesting that what the chapter is trying to do is create a distance of sorts between Esther, who's on the inside of the palace, and Mordechai on the outside of the palace, the function of which is to underscore the difficulty now in convincing Esther to save the Jewish people, given the distance between them. That's certainly a possibility. I have the following several thoughts about this phrase. First of all, let me point out simply that it goes hand in hand with something else, which is very important for a global issue in the Megillah. In this chapter, there are two rules that are clear. One is you can't enter the king's gate if you're wearing sackcloth. And the second rule that appears later, Esther's argument, is that when Mordechai says, go save the Jews, she says, I can't go into the king, because anybody who enters the inner chamber of the king, who's not been called, is put to death. And I haven't been called for 30 days. So the second rule then in this chapter is you may not enter the inner sanctum of the king unless you are called. And if you do enter, you're put to death. Now these two rules actually, A, you can't enter the court of the king with sackcloth, and B, you can't enter the inner chamber unless you have permission. And if you do, you're put to death. Those two rules are two rules that we find in the book of Vayikra, which are actually connected to each other. The first rule, that you can't be in the temple if you're wearing sackcloth, that is to say, you can't be a mourner in the temple, is explicit in the Chumash, in the story of Aaron's, the death of Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu. And Moshe says to him, carry on the work. Bikrovaya Kodesh, you cannot mourn. The other people will mourn. Achechem, Kobet Yisrael, Yivku, Etasreifah. That's number one. The second rule, that you can't enter the temple, inner part of the temple, the Holy of Holies, without permission, is a few chapters later in Vayikra, and the Torah begins it by telling that God spoke to Moshe, Acharei Motshnei Bnei Aaron, after the death of Aaron's sons who died, B'karvotam Lifnei Hashem Vayamutu, and the Torah continues, say this to Aaron, you may not enter lest you die, with this may you enter, B'zot Yavo Aaron El HaKodesh, B'far Ben B'chol Chatot V'yayu Le'olah. In other words, that's what permits you to enter. So the two rules of the two of the critical rules of the temple in the book of Vayikra, which are connected to each other, are being cited here in effect by the author of the Megillah to make the following point, which is a very important point. That in this book, if you read through the Achashverosh and his palaces and his places, it's clear that in the book where God never appears, but Achashverosh is represented as having his sanctuaries, his palaces, very similar to God's palaces in the Torah. In other words, in a certain sense, one might say, Achashverosh, in a sense, replaces God in this book, and that's a very important point. Replaces God, and there is no overt God in Megillat Esther. Einenu basipur, as we would say. God's not in the book. There may be allusions to God, but clearly God is not in this book. That's one point. But the second point is this. What do you mean you can't enter the gate? There are two points related. First of all, you get the sense that if he could enter, he would. He can't enter the gate means, it wasn't to enter the gate of the king in this context, in this chapter.
To make a claim for justice.
That's right. It means to go to the king. She says, he makes that clear. He asks Esther to go to the king and to beg the king for her people. So the only way you can get to the king, of course, is by going to the king. King's inside the palace. So the text makes two points then. A, that Mordechai would like to do it himself, if possible, but he can't. And B, that the only person who can do it, and this is very important, is somebody who's not in mourning. But every Jew is in mourning. That's what it says. In every state, every Jew is in mourning. There's only one Jew who's not in mourning in this book. Queen Jew is not in mourning, but all other Jews are in mourning. And therefore, the fate of the Jewish people will rest upon the one Jew who's not mourning. That's a very scary situation. Because as we'll see in this, it's a very important point for the chapter. The important point for the chapter, Esther emerges the hero of this book. But we should never forget that her first statement or two is, I can't do it. That's a very important point. We are relying upon somebody who has been told for a good part of her life, tell nobody you're a Jew, and as we'll see, doesn't respond as a Jew initially in this chapter. So this, you can't enter the gate wearing sackcloth, carries with it several significances over here. But the one I'm most interested in for our purpose is, that on one hand, Mordechai would like to be the one to do it. And in fact, to be very blunt about it, he's the one who should do it. He's the one who should save us for a very simple reason. He's the one that got us in the mess in the first place. So therefore, who else but Mordechai should do it? He's the one who put the gun to our head. So help us. It's your responsibility. It's your fault. Whether it's his fault or not is not the point. But the point is, de facto, he's the one who caused the problem. But he can't. Therefore, he has to rely upon his cousin, who up to this point has obeyed everything he says, as we're told in chapter 2, to bail us out. That's the first point. Yeah?
But he actually could. He could discard the sackcloth and put on the
Well, let's put it this way. The point of the Megillah isn't so much about Mordechai. The point is about who can save the Jewish people. Mordechai actually cannot save the Jews. And I'll tell you why. It becomes clear later, but I'll tell you why. Because he has no clue how to save the Jews. His idea of saving the Jews, and he says it straight out, go to the king and beg him for your people. Wrong. That will not work. That is a hopeless path. Because that presumes that the guy on the other side is actually cares one whit one way or the other. And it's clear in this book that he doesn't. He's not even an anti-Semite, by the way. Ahasuerus doesn't hate the Jews. He doesn't care about them or anybody else. Only about himself. That's what Esther understands. She understands him better. One might say only the people on the inside truly understand. And Mordechai, as clever as he is, doesn't actually get it. He thinks you can reason. We'll talk, we'll reason it out, honest discussion, we'll convince him the fairness of our position. She's laughing her head off when I'm saying this. Esther, are you kidding? Forget it. That's not going to happen. There's only one way to save the Jews, which is to make it clear it's in his own interest, which is her. But that's another story. So he actually can save them. That's the point over here. It's actually a very important point. In any event, that's the first point. Now we come to something else over here. So that's the Shaar HaMelech. There's something interesting about the order of the verses here. Esther sends clothing to dress Mordechai. The verse before says that her maidservants told her. They told her, right? The maidservants tell her. What did the maidservants tell her? Vatavona narot Esther v'yagidula. What v'yagidula? It's very unclear. What did they tell her? What does it say? They told her what? So it's like this. The verse says this. Mordechai is wearing sackcloth. The next verse says all Jews are wearing sackcloth. All Jews are mourning. The next verse says, and the maidservants told her, and she was very upset. Vatitchalchal. It's an interesting word. They call it upset, fearful, distraught, whatever. And she sends clothing to dress Mordechai, but he refuses to accept it. So what did they tell her? There's an ambiguity in the text, and it's actually very significant. They could have told her many things. They could have told her, your cousin, Mordechai the Jew or whatever, is outside the gate and he's wearing sackcloth. That's possible. They certainly told her that, because then she sends them. Did they tell her, all Jews are in mourning? Did they tell her more, or did they only tell her about Mordechai? Answer, we can't know. Sounds like they told her both. You can make the argument, how would they know about all the Jews? Maybe they only know about Mordechai. But apparently he's not the only person mourning. If all the Jews in all the states are mourning, it can't be that Mordechai is the only one in Shushan that's mourning. Because the writing's on the wall. So what it sounds like is that, and this, you might think, you might say, or not, what's the difference? But there's a big difference. Because in one case, if she only knows about Mordechai, she deals with Mordechai. But if she knows about all the Jews, which is what it sounds like, and she only sends the clothing to Mordechai, then she's leaving a different message, which is, I can save you. I don't know about them. As far as you're concerned, cousin, surrogate father, or whatever, I can save you. I can help you out. Get your ass, forget about it. It's not going to affect you. But it's for low-key bail. He doesn't accept it. I mentioned in one of the shiurim on Shabbat or something, it reminds us of another story, actually, that Megillah cites a million times, but in the Joseph story, when Jacob is mourning for his son, Joseph, and the sons and the daughters arose to console him. Vayima'en lehit nachem. He refuses to be consoled. He refuses. He's wearing sackcloth, and the same thing. He tore his clothing, he's wearing sackcloth. They arose to console him. Get your ass, father. He refuses. Because once he accepts the consolation, he admits Joseph is dead. He doesn't want to. I don't accept it. In the case of Mordechai, I can't put my own clothing on if the Jewish people are in trouble. I'm part of them. How could I? I refuse to accept it. It's not clear what she's thinking. Anyway, that's the first step of the story, first stage. Mordechai, we are then told in the next verse, that at that point, Esther sends a messenger, one of the officers of the king, to Mordechai, Radat mazev yamazet. Understand what is actually going on. What is actually tell me all the details. So this messenger comes to the street, And then Mordechai tells him all that has transpired. He shows him the, tells him about the money that Haman has offered to put up to kill all the Jews. He shows him the official decree. And he instructs him to go back to Esther to beg the king, to beg the king and to request for her people. That's what Mordechai says. He commands her, it says. Remember, earlier in this book, Megillah says that everything he commands, she listens to. So he gives another command, hoping that she'll listen to this command. Her response, though, is very instructive. Her response begins in verse number 11. Kol avdei ha-melech v'yam medinot ha-melech yodim. All the servants of the king and all people of the king's states know. Asher kol ish v'isha asher avol ha-melech v'chatzera pnimit asher lo yikare achata tolu. Everybody knows that if you enter the king's chamber, inner chamber, without being called, you're put to death. That's the law, she says. Except if the king extends his scepter. I haven't been called for 30 days. So what does that mean? What's he saying? He says, no, I can't help you here. Because it's too risky. Because I could be put to death. That's what she says explicitly. Then there's another intimation over here. Achat datol hamit. The law is you are put to death. I suggest that she's saying more than just it's dangerous, but that's illegal. Remember that the dot in this book, the law, is probably very much related. Well, the book says, when the king issues a decree and seals it, you can never change it. There's something about the Megillah, which I would call fate or destiny. What is sealed cannot be changed. You cast a lot to determine when it's going to happen, who are goral. Whatever day, Haman casts his lots before he actually goes to the king to determine the day. There's something kind of the very strong deterministic element over here. So what she's saying is two things. You can't break the law, but above all, it's dangerous. But she actually is saying something else, which is very striking, or maybe the writer is saying something else. Her response to Mordechai in verse 11 begins with the words, "Kol Avdei ha-melech v'yam medinot ha-melech yodim." Everybody in the court, all the servants of the king and all the peoples of the states know. Everybody knows, right? How did the chapter begin? Well, how does this chapter begin? This is one of the great chapters, actually the Bible, but the great... Well, Mordechai yoda, that's how the chapter... Mordechai knew. Mordechai knew all that was happening. That's how the chapter begins. And now Esther sends back to Mordechai, everybody knows. The question always is, who is everybody, you know? Who is everybody? The old joke, Yogi Berra in baseball in the States. They ask Yogi, do you still get two chores in Midtown? Do you boys still go eat that restaurant? Are you kidding? He says, nobody goes there anymore. It's just too crowded. You know, that's the point is, it's a very good joke, actually. Because what the joke is hinging on is, who is everybody? Nobody goes there. Who's nobody? You know, there are billions of people on the planet. But the truth is, what is my planet? Maybe my family. Maybe it's a couple of relatives. Three friends. That's my world. And we have many other worlds. But the point is, who is Mordechai's world? You know what Mordechai is? He's a Jew. He gets up in the morning. He puts on the news or puts on the internet or whatever. What's happening in the Middle East? What's happening in Israel? Well, how are the Jews doing, you know? Then he was looking at the other stuff in the sports pages or whatever, local. Esther, that's Mordechai knows. Esther doesn't know from the Jews. What does she know? She knows the protocols of the palace. She's a Persian woman. What does she know? She was told for many years not to say you're a Jew. And she's done a very good job. No one knows she's Jewish. The 12th year, she's queen in year 7. She's been queen for 5 years. And nobody knows she's a Jew. How's that possible? There's only one answer. She isn't a Jew. How else can you explain it? There's no intimation in this book that she observed, ever, that she observes anything Jewish. How would you know? So that's the problem. They're living in two different worlds. It's not just it comes to that liminal point of the gate, which he can't enter. They're two worlds. She knows one thing. Everybody knows, she says, right? Everybody knows this. Everybody knows the rules of the court. What are you kidding me? And it's dangerous. And besides, you don't break the laws. Mordechai is faced with a problem, part of which he actually created. He instructed her not to say you're a Jew. So she's obeyed him. So So now we have the following conversation, one of the great moments of the Megillah. Vayomer Mordechai lo Ashiva l'Esther. Mordechai sends the following message to Esther. Al tadami b'nafshech limolet beit ha-melech mikol ha-yehudim. Don't think, don't imagine, he says, you will escape the fate of the Jews. Ki emacharesh tacharishi bo'et hazot, revach v'atzala yamodu ha-yehudim mimokom acher, v'yatu beit ha-vich tovedu. U'mi yodeya, im li'et kozot yigat la-malchut. Okay, we could spend a lot of time on these verses. I'm going to say only a couple of things. But if you, he says two, he has two arguments, actually, which in a certain degree are contradictory, but they're two arguments. The first argument is, don't think that you're going to save yourself, or maybe by extension me, and they're going to perish. But quite the opposite. Who knows, he says. Maybe they'll survive and will perish. Maybe someone else will save them. His point, though, is, I'm just to fine-tune it, is the following. The key words are ba'et hazot, if you are silent at this time. Well, he's not saying there are other ways. There are other ways. Find the other ways. He's not saying that. He's saying something different. At this time, there's one way. Ba'et hazot. That's a phrase that appears twice here. At this time, there's only you. But let me tell you something. If you don't do it at this time, immediately, then maybe at a different time, another place, another time, someone else will save the people, and you'll be doomed. And therefore, that's one thing. And secondly, he says something different, which is, who knows, he says, maybe this is why you became the queen. Maybe this is your calling. Maybe this is your responsibility. This is your moment in history to step up to the plate. This is your opportunity and your responsibility. Those are two different arguments, but that's what he says. So now Esther responds to this. Very powerful. He says, Esther responds in the following way. Esther says, sends a message back to Mordechai. Lech knoset kol ha-yudim anim sim b'shushan. Gather all the Jews in Shushan. V'tzumu alai and fast for me. V'yal tochu v'yal tishtu shloshet yimim laila v'yom. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days and nights. Gam ani v'naro tayot tzum kein. I and my maidens will also fast. I will enter the gate of the king against the law. I will break the law. If I perish, I perish. So I wanted to say two things over here. First of all, about what locally what it's saying. Then I wanted to take us to a different text, which is very much connected. I would say the text upon which is actually related, maybe even based. Mordechai says his argument is interesting, but he added something else to what I mentioned before. He makes a very interesting point over here. He says, "Umi yodeya im li'et kozot igat ramalchut." Mi yodeya means, what do we know? What do we know? The idea of knowledge is very central. The term to know appears in this book seven times, maybe eight times, seven or eight, depending on how you count it up. This chapter is all about knowing. Mordechai knows all that's happening. Esther knows the court protocols. They're living in two different worlds. Mordechai makes an argument that she has to take the risk. And he says, "There umi yodeya. Who knows, maybe this is why you became the queen." In other words, what he's saying is, when I'm saying you have to take this path, it's not because I'm sure that you will succeed. Who knows? We don't know the workings of God. We don't know the workings of the world. We don't know anything. We know one thing. We got to do the right thing. That's all we know. Umi yodeya. To which Esther responds. Her response is, okay, gather all the Jews and fast for me, we'll all fast. I will go into the king, she says, against the law, shelo kadat. B'chasher avadati, avadati, if I perish, I perish, which means, not because I'm convinced I will succeed. We have no guarantees, not convinced, but because I'm going to do the right thing. And because it might succeed, which is already counter to the thinking of the Persians as described in this book. Counter to the idea of fate, a fate that you cannot change. You can't overturn it. What Esther is claiming over here and Mordechai is claiming is that maybe you can. But they're certainly not guaranteeing that you can. That's out of the chapter. Now, you read this dialogue, and of course the next verse is Vayavor Mordechai Vayaz. Mordechai passed over and did as Esther commanded him. It's one of the turning points of the Megillah. He's suddenly receiving the commands. Up to now, he gave the commands. He commands her what to do. But at this point, she commands him what to do. That is to say, Esther accepts the responsibility, but she's not going to do what he told her to do. What he told her to do was to beg the king. That is not happening. Not right away. She begs the king later. But the first thing is a different plan of Esther, which she devises, namely, the two parties. The two parties are intended to accomplish one thing, which is to set Haman and Ahasuerus against each other. Because the two parties, of course, are, especially the second party, come to the party that I make for you, plural. For Haman, who's already an egomaniac to start with, it puffs him up to the degree that he begins to think the unthinkable thought, which will get him killed. Something you cannot think. I remember Ed Koch, who died recently, mayor of New York. When he was the mayor, there were a lot of no parking zones in the city. But he had a new sign up. It's a big sign. The sign was, "Don't even think of parking here." That was his sign, Koch's sign. And here's what I would say to Haman. Don't even think this thought. Because if you think it, you're going to be dead. The thought is, maybe I could be king. And of course, that's exactly the thought that he thinks in the hilarious sixth chapter, when the king asks him the question, what should be to the one the king wishes to honor? And Haman, of course, says to himself, and depending how you read the Megillah, there are two different ways to read this book, but if you read it, he's not a fool. He knows this. It's really a test of Haman. He knows that Haman's thinking about himself, and the king may know that. Let's assume the king does know it. What are you after, Haman? The queen invites me and you to a party together. Three's a crowd. What are you after? Oh, take the clothing of the king, not good. And take the horse of the king, not good. And place the crown of the king. You're finished. The crown is his little, that's what Vashti had to come with, wearing the crown. Places the crown on Esther's head. You don't touch the crown. So Haman, the egomaniac, has been puffed up to the extent, why not? He eats with the queen, I eat with the queen, right? The king, on the other hand, has a different take on this little trio, which is, why is Haman invited? Dangerous. The people closest to you are most dangerous. So let's check the record books. The king can't sleep. The egomaniac and the paranoid. Collision course. So he finds, of course, not by accident. You could also read it the other way. It's accident, but let's say not by accident. What do we know about Haman's enemies? He saved my life. How was he rewarded? Never rewarded. For the paranoid, that's enough. And Haman walks in to tell the king no less what to do. To hang Mordechai on the gallows he's already constructed, the chutzpah. He's already, before he asks. The same way he cast the lots before he asked the king. That's Esther's plan. To convince the king the real enemy is Haman. That's the plan. Once you convince the king the enemy is Haman, everything else can follow. Because then it's not about the Jews. Then it's about helping the king. We have the same enemy. We're in this together. We're fast friends. That's Esther's plan. Mordechai's plan is suicidal, actually. To go beg the king. She begs the king. Always, even when she begs the king later, it's not so simple. But she can't beg the king right away. Now, what is the story that the Megillah is alluding to over here? This one story it's alluding to. Everybody knows that the Megillah has many allusions to other biblical texts. But one of the primary ones, if not the primary one, is the Joseph story, the larger Joseph narrative. There are many dozens and dozens of allusions to Joseph. The question is not just how to discuss, to see them, but how to interpret them. So in the time that we have, and how much time do we have? What time is it, 3:05? No, it goes to 3:50, we have to 3:14. 20 minutes. In the next 20 minutes, 25, we will see what story the Megillah writer chose from the Joseph story. Now, this is actually a very interesting point, because the Megillah, let's say, has 70 allusions to Joseph, but there are certain ones that are central in the book. There are critical moments in the Megillah. This is certainly one of them. Convincing Esther to intercede is certainly one of the critical moments. The Megillah writer chooses within the Joseph narrative a story that's parallel, or maybe the base for it, and you can see from that what the Megillah writer thinks is central in the Joseph story. That's very interesting. It's not just about citing texts. The Megillah is also interpreting texts. What is the story that the Megillah thinks is a critical story? This is the critical moment. So what is this parallel in the Joseph story? And the answer is clear. The parallel in the Joseph story is the following story. It's when the brothers go down to Egypt to get food. And when they're in Egypt, Joseph accuses them of being spies. And at the end of the day, he takes a hostage, the second brother, Shimon. And he says to the brothers, who have talked about their family, we have a younger brother, he says, I'll tell you what, go back home. Shimon's a hostage. Go back home and bring this other brother you claim exists down here. And if you bring the other brother down here, I'll see you speak the truth. So the brothers all head back with the food for the family, and they get back home to meet their father Yaakov and to tell him what's happened. This takes place in the book of Bereishit. Let's find that. Chapter, was it 42? 49. I think it's 42, actually. Let's see. I believe it's the end of chapter 42. He sends them in 42. They return to him at the end of chapter 42. Vayavo Yaakov Avihem in verse number 29. Verse 29 of chapter 42 of Bereishit. They returned to their father and they told him what had happened. The man of the land spoke harshly to us, they say. He accused us of being spies. We said, we're not spies. We're 12 brothers, right? The little one at home with the old father. And he said to us in verse number 33, okay, then bring this other brother down. We'll see you're honest, right? And then you come back, and if you come back, I'll give you food, etc., etc. Bring your little guy down, the little brother down. Fine. Then the Torah continues. As they were opening their sacks, everybody saw their money had been returned. They have the money in the sack. And when they saw this, they and their father, they were afraid. Vayirou. Here comes the critical moment in the story. This is, from here on, is the critical moment, as the Megillah sees it, in the larger Joseph narrative. So let's look at these verses. Vayomer Alehem Yaakov Avihem. We start with this verse. Otishi Kaltem. You have made me bereft. You have caused me to lose my children. Yosef Einenu V'Shimon Einenu. Joseph is missing and Shimon is missing. V'et Binyamin Tikachu. And you would take Benjamin. Olai Hayu Kulana. All of these things are on me. It's a striking verse. First of all, you see for the first time that Jacob actually accuses his sons about Joseph. Otishi Kaltem. You have caused me to be bereft. Yosef Einenu. What does that have to do with Joseph? He was eaten by an animal. He doesn't believe that. Now he's wondering. You see, in most families, if you come home, four sibs leave. Three come back with a lot of money missing a brother. In most families, we wouldn't assume that they sold their brother for money. I don't think we would assume that. That's in most families. That's not true in Jacob's family. Because in Jacob's family, it's very likely, certainly possible, that they sold their brother for money. In fact, that's what they planned to do with Joseph. Whether they actually sold Joseph, I don't think they actually, in the text, actually sell him. But they certainly caused his sale, and they wanted to sell him. And the chief guy was Yehuda. Vayomer Yehuda lechav mabetza ki narogat achinu. What benefit is there to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Let's sell him. Let's sell him for money. Nimkarenu, let's sell our brother, but not kill him. And now the brothers return from Egypt with money, minus Shimon. Says Jacob, you have caused me, he accuses his children, you've caused me to lose my children. Joseph is missing and Shimon. And now you're going to take Binyamin also? Olai hayu kulana. Why are all these things happening? It's all on me, he says. No one cares, but all the things you do, it's on my head. Olai hayu kulana. At this point, in other words, what's he saying de facto? Lemaisa, what's he saying? Binyamin's not going. Forget it. It's not happening. I'm not sending Benjamin with you fellas. I don't trust you. You'll kill him the way you killed the others or whatever. He'll somehow disappear. It's not happening. At this point, of course, if he doesn't send Benjamin, Shimon is stuck forever in jail. Shimon's gone. And they also have no food. It's actually deeper. The Chumash is even much deeper than this, because the truth is, without getting into all the details of it, Jacob's dream in the book of Genesis is to build what he calls the house. Jacob's vow, right? This rock that I set up shall become the house of God. Jacob refers to his family several times in Bereishit as Beiti. Umatai esei gam anochilu Beiti. V'nishimadeti anyu Beiti. For Jacob, that means the inclusive structure. Unlike Abraham, or unlike Isaac, who choose one child to be covenantal. Jacob's dream is that to build the inclusive, everybody's included. So in point of fact, if you don't get Joseph back, if you don't get Shimon back, then you have no house. It's not just you lose them. You lose everything. You lose your dream. You lose the idea of building this family. Everybody's included. Jacob, at the end of the book, succeeds. He blesses all his sons. Everyone gets a blessing. Some get better blessings. Some get worse blessings. But they're all blessed. It means they're all included. So what's at stake is actually the family. Everybody's at stake over here, not just one person. How are we going to... But we're at an impasse. So we have an attempt, the first attempt, to convince Jacob to send Benjamin, to somehow try to rebuild the family. The first child is Reuven. Reuven says to his father, the end of this chapter, send the boy with me, right? Not exactly. Shnei banai tamit im lo avigenim. Father, if I don't bring him back to you, you can kill my two sons, he says. You can kill my two sons. Give them to me. To which Jacob says, my son's not going. Now the point here about you can kill my two sons, Rashi makes the Midrash, he cites the Midrash, Tuchor Shote, who's there, my eldest son is an idiot, they write the Midrash. What do I gain by killing my two grandchildren? Well, what do I get killing my grandchildren? But actually, the point is something else, which is, that's true. There's actually something else about Reuven that's very problematic, which is, if you want to take responsibility for something, you don't do it by saying, the next guy's going to do it. By the way, which character is Reuven similar to in Genesis? Does exactly the same thing. Who does exactly the same thing as Reuven? Another guy who might have amounted to something, but doesn't. Lot. Lot offers his daughters. His guests are being attacked. Don't harm my guests. Take my daughters instead, my two daughters. I mean, the point is, what he could have said is take nobody or come get me. Make my day. He could have said, okay, so anything. Like, right, but let me take my two daughters. It's the same. This is not responsibility. There's a reason Lot has no influence on anybody. Doesn't take responsibility. So Jacob's answer is no. The first attempt in this conversation is a failure. My son is not going. And now the famine gets worse. The famine gets worse. And Jacob says, this is a classic. Jacob says to his kids at the beginning of chapter 43, let's get food. So they say, Father, we can't get food unless we bring Binyamin. So Jacob says, who told you to tell him you have a son altogether, a brother? Why'd you tell him? What do you mean, why we tell him? He asks all these questions. How are we supposed to know? Then Yehuda speaks up. In other words, what you have typically is called deflection. Because it happens all the time. Why'd you tell him you have a brother? The answer is, who cares? That's the true answer. We did tell him. Okay, now we got to deal with the fact that we told him. Then Yehuda speaks. This whole other conversation is Jacob and all his sons. By Yom Yehuda, Judah then speaks. And what does he say? Shulcha ha-nari ti. Send the boy with me, he says. Send the boy with me, and we will go and return. And then he continues. Anochi ervenu, I take responsibility. Miyadi tevakshenu, seek him from my hands. If I don't bring him back to you, count me a sinner all of my days. And if we hadn't tarried, could have come back twice already. And Jacob says to Judah, if so, Imkain, do this. Bring back the money. Take extra money down there. Maybe it was a mistake. And bring him gifts from the land. And may the God of mercy help you, he says. And bring back your other brother and Benjamin. As for me, the last words are, Kasher shakolti shakolti. If I am bereft, I am bereft. Now the Megillah writer took those last three words, Kasher shakolti shakolti, but changed it to Kasher avadati avadati. If I perish, I perish. Now, what does the Megillah writer see in the story? It's interesting. Obviously, Kasher shakolti shakolti for Jacob is an end of the story. The story begins with the words, Otishi kaltem. That's how he starts. You have made me bereft. The last two words are shakolti, shakolti. If I am bereft, I am bereft. The Megillah writer sees a parallel in the two stories. The parallel is the following. First of all, in each case, you have a very dangerous situation, and in order to solve the problem, which threatens everybody, you have to approach the king. In each case, there's a problem with that. In the case of Ahasuerus, it's dangerous because you can get killed. In the case of this Mishneh or Melech, this viceroy or whatever, he's not to be trusted because we might say Mamanavshach. Either the money is theirs because they sold Shimon as a slave, in which case it's hopeless, or the money is there because somebody's framing them, which is also problematic. How did the money get there? They're all afraid. They don't understand it. How do we get this money back? What's happening? Someone's out to get us. In each of the two stories, there were two attempts to solve the problem, the first of which fails. I mentioned earlier that sending the sackcloth to the clothing to Mordechai has a parallel in the earlier story, where Jacob is mourning the disappearance of Joseph and refuses to accept the consolations. The parallel in this story, though, is Reuven's attempt. Reuven says, I'm going to solve the problem. Says Jacob, it's not happening. And that's the first stage in the Mordechai-Esther conversation. Listen, go to the king and beg the king for your people. I can't do that, she says, because it's too dangerous. It's against the law. I can't do it. Not happening. Now we need plan B. Now he comes up with a different point. The different point is this is your responsibility. This is your obligation. And he adds, and if you don't do it, maybe someone else will do it. So from both a pragmatic standpoint, that someone later might solve the problem, but also from a, one might say, a religious standpoint, an ethical standpoint, this is your moment. And this, in fact, does work, but Esther ends up by saying, Kasher avadati, avadati, I'll do it, even though I may perish. What's interesting is, I think the writer of the story has actually something else in mind on top of this, actually several things. I'll mention a couple of them. One is, what actually happens to Jacob? Jacob is afraid. If I send my Benjamin with you, I will lose. Kasher shakav, I will lose children. What actually happens in the story to Yaakov? Does he lose children? He actually gains children. Where does he gain children? Exactly, Ephraim and Menashe. The story of Ephraim and Menashe, where he actually gains children, how does the Torah describe that story? Jacob goes down to Egypt and he sees Joseph. And he says to Joseph, your sons, Ephraim and Menashe, what does he say? Kiruvein v'Shimon yiuli, they're like my sons. He adopts them. He actually adopts two sons. And when he adopts them, they're now his sons, not just his grandchildren, but his children, he's going to also bless them. The blessing is conferred often from father to son. In the blessing of Menashe and Ephraim, he and Joseph have a little dispute. The dispute is which of the two sons is primary. Joseph thinks Menashe is primary because he's my oldest son. Jacob thinks Ephraim is primary. How does Jacob demonstrate that Ephraim is primary? He puts his right hand on the head of Ephraim and the left on the head of Menashe. What is the word in the Chumash to describe what he does? How do you spell Sikael? Right. In the unvocalized Hebrew, how else can we read Sikael? Of course. It's exactly. The Chumash plays off that. Instead of losing, instead of Eshkol, he gains Sikael et Yadav. And the truth is, something very deep about that story, because what Jacob is saying is, the only way they can be my children is in this order. And for the following reason, it's not an accident. Because in that story, what do we know about Ephraim and Menashe? That is true. The way the names are given, that is true. True point. That is a true point. But the main thing we know about Ephraim and Menashe, we know nothing about their lives. We know their names. Menashe means forgetfulness. Ephraim means God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Ephraim is a representation that Mitzrayim is a place of suffering, not a good place. Menashe is about forgetting the past, about forgetting his father's house and the suffering of the father's house. Says Jacob, the only way you can move forward, Ephraim gets and Menashe get the same blessing. The only way you can incorporate Menashe is if first you understand what is Mitzrayim. Eretz Onyi, a place of suffering. It's a covenantal word in Genesis. I can only include them this way, says Jacob, Ephraim first, Menashe second. The Megillah does the same thing with Esther, by the way. Kasher avadati, avadati. If I perish, I perish. She's worried about perishing, but in the Megillah, what actually happens when she intervenes? Hargu hayudim viabed chamesh meos ish. The Jews actually cause their enemies to perish. Esther's intervention not only saves the Jews, but destroys the enemy. And which, by the way, just as a small point, was not Esther's initial intention. Esther's initial intention, this is actually an interesting point, people think the Megillah is a bloody book and this and that. The fact of the matter is, Esther doesn't want to kill anybody. Esther goes to the king and says, rescind the decree. Rescind, take back the decree. Nobody gets killed. There's no war. He said there's a war on the 13th of Adar. Lashiv et ha-sfarim. Call off your war. Says Achashverosh, I can't do that. Because it's already, so you can't change it. Okay, but I'll tell you what. Issue a second decree that there is a war, but I back your side. Fact of the matter is, and in that war, which we didn't want, we kill the enemy, Hargu Hedim V'Abed. So ironically, Esther was concerned about Kasher Avadati Avadati, but in fact, the Jews not only survive, they actually eliminate the enemies. Let me make one last point about these two stories, about that. When you put them together, it's something else very interesting. When you read that first story, when you actually read it without rose-colored glasses, it's very important when you read anything. Let's see what it really says, you know? Let's be metarits everything. It's clear. Jacob says to his kids, you have murdered my children. He says it straight out. Otishi kaltem, you've caused me to, you're killing my family. Literally, not figuratively. He says, you know something? Joseph is missing. Shimon is missing. Suggests that the two of them in the same boat. Now you take Benjamin. Olai hayu kulana. All of these, it's so human. All of these things are on me. That's what he says. It's all on me. Olai hayu kulana. You might say it's self-centered, but all mourning is self-centered, actually, because you think about your own sorrows. It's totally human. And he sees no way out because he doesn't really trust anybody. What does the Megillah do with Olai hayu kulana? It's all on me. See, interesting. So Esther sends back a message to Mordechai. Gather all the Jews, she says. Gather all the Jews. V'tzumu olai. It's interesting about, we have Tainis Esther. It's different than all the other, for Tainis Esther is not in the Gemara altogether. It's a minug. The Gemara never mentions Tainis Esther. But there's something different about Tainis Esther, different halachas also. First of all the other fasts, you always delay the fast. Let's say fast falls on Shabbat. So you fast later. The only fast, one fast you fast earlier, is Tainis Esther. It's a different fast. It's a preliminary to Purim. And I think one of the differences with Tzumu Olai, what Tainis Esther is about, the book, after all, never mentions God altogether. She's saying something different. I will go into the king. I will risk my life. Gather all the Jews together. For Tzumu Olai. What she's saying is, demonstrate your solidarity with me. Fast for me, pray for me, fast for me. Think of me when I'm going in. I am representing the Jewish people. And I'll tell you something, she says, Gamaniva Narotai Otsum Kain. And I also, with my maidservants, with my Persian maidservants, we're also going to fast. I'm going to fast also, because I'm thinking of you. Uvechenavo Amelcha Shelo Kadat. I will enter the king's chamber against the law. I'll break the law. What's interesting is, of course, that when she does speak to the king, the next chapter begins, on the third day she wore the royal garments. What she really is saying to Mordechai is, I can't save you as a Jew. If I go in as a Jew, we're going to lose. I can't do that. I've got to save you as a Persian. So me and my Persian maidservants, but quietly, secretly, we're all in this thing together. Esther the queen, she's never called Esther the Jew. Esther the queen will go in and try to save the Jewish people. But what's important over here is understanding we're all in this mess together. So therefore, Tzumu Olai, you fast for me. So the Megillah writer takes the story of Jacob. Olai hayu kulana, you know? Which there means, it's only on me. You know, you boys don't care, he says. It's all on me. And the Megillah reverses it all in that sense and says, when Esther agrees to go, she's really accepting Mordechai's basic teaching, which is, the reason he didn't accept the calling in the first place. Maybe I can save myself, but it's not about me. It's about us. That's what Mordechai says. That's what Tainis Esther in Purim is really about, on one level. The deep point. That Vitzumu Olai, she says, you fast for me. So my point over here is, just to conclude, to point out that through the prism of the Megillah, we subtly understand something about that story of Joseph in the book of Genesis. And I'll tell you something else. When you think about it more deeply, I'll leave you with a question, best way to leave. That's chapter 43. Judah says to his father, Anochi Erevenu, Miyodi Tevakshenu. You come to me and you can come to me personally from my hand. But also, Anochi Erevenu, I guarantee it. The term Arev appears in the Torah in one story as a central word, Judah and Tamar. Eravon. It's the guarantee that Judah gives to Tamar in lieu of payment. And she holds on to this thing. She only returns it to him when he confesses. Later in the Chumash, Judah says to Joseph, take me instead of Benjamin. Why? Ki avdecha arav et hanar, if I've guaranteed it. So my point is that the writer of the Megillah didn't actually invent this about the story. That this is the critical moment when Judah says, I take responsibility. Personal responsibility. Not my two sons, not anybody else. Come to me personally. And if I don't do it, I'm a sinner. The Megillah writer understands that and builds off that and plays off it in the story of Esther. And it's actually very interesting to understand how, through other books of the Bible, very often it's a lens and it really illuminates for us earlier stories of the Torah. In this case, one of the great moments. It's a Joseph narrative, but it's not actually Joseph. And who are Judah and Jacob in the story? It's interesting. Judah is the one who asked his father to send Benjamin. So in that sense, Mordechai is Judah. On the other hand, Judah is the one who goes. In that sense, Esther is Judah. So it's the two pieces of Judah. The Megillah writer took the two pieces of Judah, split it in half. One is Mordechai and one is Esther for the simple reason. If Mordechai could go, he would go. That's the point. Because after all, why is it Judah? Because Judah is the one who sold Joseph. He's the one who says, sell him. Therefore, it's Judah's responsibility. The one who creates the problem has to solve the problem. But in the Megillah, Mordechai can't do it. Because he can't enter the gate with sackcloth. The Jew can't save them. And therefore, Mordechai and Esther have to be a team. Mordechai encourages her to go, and insists she goes. At the end of the day, it's going to be Esther's plan that saves us. Anyway, thank you very much.